Future-proof. The Faster Proof Special.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around...
When it's nighttime, does the sun go cold?
What?
When it's nighttime, does the sun go cold?
When it's nighttime, does the sun go cold? No, Colin, the sun stays hot the whole time. It's just we can't see it because it's the other side of the earth. I'm doing my program, so... Would you mind? Thanks. If you'd like to email us on the program, you can do so, science@newstalk.com. You can also text us for...
Dad, how do cheetahs run so fast?
Cheetahs run very fast because they have very powerful back legs. Cohen, I did say I'm trying to do the program, so if you don't mind, just thank you. For 30 cent,
Are you in mom's belly?
What? What?
Were you in mom's belly?
Was I in mom's belly? No, Cohen, you were in mom's belly. Remember?
Yeah.
Okay, go away now.
Dad?
Oh, for the love of God.
Do you know pigs can't swim? Can you tell me all the ways you can go blind?
No.
Do you know some robots don't have any necks? Dad? Do pussycats like pancakes? Are granny's teeth real?
Are granny's teeth real? Yeah. I get asked a lot of questions I can't answer. Many of them come as questions from you, the listener. And sometimes they're hard questions. Sometimes they make no sense. And sometimes we don't even know where to begin to start to answer them. And so today we're going to do something a little bit different on the programme. We're going to take your most interesting questions and follow them wherever they take us. And we're going to try and do as many of those in the space of an hour as is tolerable. We're calling it Faster Proof. Okay, so producer of the program, Aidan McKelvey, is in the cockpit piloting this episode. So what are we talking about? Thousands of questions, hundreds of questions, five questions?
Well, we've loads of questions, so let's just try and get to some sort of an answer and we'll see how many we can get through.
Okay, so what's up first?
My name is Karen Lloyd. I'm an assistant professor of microbiology at the University of Tennessee.
Karen, this is a really good one because I don't know the answer to it, and it poses some really interesting questions, but I presume there's a yes or no answer. If I can see a flea, can a flea see bacteria?
It's not a yes or no answer.
Great.
Sorry. Because I think you have to think about the resolving power of the eyes or oculars or whatever of a flea versus that of a human. You can't just do the size differential. And so, for instance, like a hawk can see really, really finely resolved things from very far away, even though it's actually got a smaller body than we do.
So just to jump in here, the problem with this question in principle is that we don't have biologically similar eyes to fleas. Fleas do have single eyes, not compound eyes like flies, but they can't form an image with them. They are light sensitive, so they can make things out, but they can't form an image in the same way we can. So I'm guessing there isn't a fixed focal length to eye size ratio that we can make this comparison with.
Exactly. But we could make the assumption that a flea can basically resolve similar things to the same way that we do in proportion to our body size. If we make that assumption, then the answer could be simple.
Oh, and that answer is?
Yes.
Ah, okay. So I didn't know that because I thought bacteria were much smaller than that. So compared to a flea, how big is a bacteria?
So unfortunately, there's a huge range in sizes of bacteria. But
sure.
If you look at just like, you know, your garden variety E. coli, they're like 1 to 3 micrometers in diameter. And a flea is somewhere around 3 millimeters in diameter. So that's about 1,000 times bigger. And so if like a person is 6 feet tall, that's roughly 2 meters, which is about 1,000 times bigger than a flea, which is about 2-ish millimeters. So we can definitely see fleas if we squint, and they're 1,000 times smaller than we are. So if a flea has the same resolving power of their eyes that we do, then a microbe is about 1,000 times smaller than them. So yeah, theoretically, they should be able to see it.
So then if we go one step down, can we go one step down? If we go from bacteria to what's like a really small virus, would a bacteria be able to see a virus?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a big range in viral size too, but theoretically, there are some viruses that are about a fifth of the size of bacteria. So yeah, that would look like maybe a puppy to them, you know, if bacteria had eyes.
If they had eyes, if these bacteria had human eyes, which of course they don't. But keeping that sort of relative frame of one, you can see 1/1,000th of what you can see, we could say a flea should be able to see a bacteria. If we kept that ratio, Karen, how big would a giant have to be to see us?
Right, like the maximum size of a giant that could still see us, that wouldn't be too big to see us.
Yeah.
Going with that same ratio, it would be about 1 kilometer tall.
Oh, that doesn't seem that high.
Yeah. Well, kilometers seem small when you lay them out on their side, but when you stack them up vertically, they're actually quite a bit.
I bet they are. Karen Lloyd, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What are you talking about? 1 kilometer isn't that high. Have you ever like climbed Carn Tool? That's about 1 kilometer. It's pretty high.
That's Aidan McKelvey, our producer, mocking me. Look, I'm not great with scale, but now that I think about it, I've been to the Burj Al Khalifa, the tallest building in the world, and that's like 700 or something, like 700 meters or so.
And that's pretty high.
It's pretty high. Okay, moving on. Our next question. Can we restart life from Sinead? That's it. That's the whole question.
That's the question.
Okay. Hello. I'm Professor Nick Lane. I'm in the Department of Genetics, Evolution and Environment at University College London.
Nick, welcome to Faster Proof.
Thank you.
This is a difficult one to answer quickly. Would it be possible to restart life?
No. not now. Times have changed. Now there's lots of oxygen in the atmosphere and there's lots of life on the planet, and that makes it very difficult to restart it again. So in a nutshell, very difficult to do it here on Earth, on the planet as we have it at the moment, with an atmosphere full of oxygen and animals and plants everywhere you look.
But I thought you need oxygen for life. Why is that a problem?
Funnily enough, oxygen at the beginning of life is a real problem, because if you think about what life is, we're made of organic molecules, and organic molecules are carbon with hydrogen attached. And basically, we get the carbon from carbon dioxide, and the hydrogen has to, in effect, bubble out of the ground, out of hydrothermal vents and places like that. And so hydrogen and CO2, we need to make them react together. And it's not easy to do. If we could do that really easily, we could solve global warming right now, and we could solve all kinds of energy problems right now. So it's a difficult thing to do. And it's partly that if there's any oxygen there, the hydrogen just reacts with oxygen and it explodes like the Hindenburg did.
Right. But so you're saying that the very origins of life, where the building blocks that would eventually become amino acids and then on
yes.
to more complicated materials that came from minerals, pressure and gases. And I always find it mad that we're having a conversation over Skype, these evolved human beings, and this is supposedly the best guess that we have, who we came from gases and minerals and nothing more. How do we have consciousness? Sorry, do you know what? I don't have time for that. No, sorry. I need to focus. So my question is, is life that began at the very beginning, does that not exist anymore? Because
no,
did
it still
transition
does.
To something that can exist in today, or... Well, why couldn't we do that? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, so there's two. I mean, it can still exist today because there are still places that are excluding oxygen, so anoxic, like our own intestines, for example, you know, like stagnant bogs. There are places where there are, you know, ancient looking bacteria that still survive by what looks like the same methods that they did maybe 4 billion years ago. But for animals and plants, we couldn't survive in those environments. You couldn't have at all animals in those environments, really. We need oxygen. But the trouble is that the kind of chemistry that gives rise to life is really inhibited by oxygen. And the things that, you know, plants can do it reasonably well in the presence of oxygen, but they're highly evolved systems. And effectively, most of that evolution happened in the first two thirds of the duration of the planet, where there wasn't any oxygen.
Right. So we could do it in a lab under pressurized or altered conditions, but naturally creating life again is impossible due to the atmospheric conditions of Earth today.
Yeah.
What about other planets? Could we reseed life that would eventually take over and, what's the word that they use in sci-fi movies, terraform a new planet?
That would be easy, I would say, in comparison, yes.
Wow.
Well, I mean, could we take bacteria from here and would they survive now on Mars? I think the answer is yes, unequivocally. They may not survive on the very surface. They may want to go underground, and you may need to think about it a little bit and do it with some care. But I think there's nothing about the conditions on Mars, and probably places like Enceladus, one of the moons of Saturn, or Europa, even Titan maybe, where life as we know it on Earth, meaning bacteria, would do okay there. You know, there are places in the solar system, I would think of moons like Enceladus, where it's more likely that life could start now than it would ever be that it could start on Earth again.
So fast forward a few hundred million years and who knows what we may have.
Well, you know, we're going there now. Who knows what's already there?
Dr. Nick Lane from UCL, thanks very much.
My pleasure, thank you.
I'm Helen Chersky, and I'm an ocean physicist at University College London.
So, Helen, thanks very much for doing this for us. As you're aware, we're trying to answer as many questions as we can on this programme. And we got this one in, which I have to say, I had to really think about it. If water boils and turns from liquid to gas at 100 degrees Celsius, then why do clothes dry on the line? Because it's not 100 degrees Celsius in the atmosphere, or we'd all be dead. So how does the liquid in clothes evaporate to the gas of presumably liquid vapor in that environment?
So the first thing is first part of this is what boiling point actually means. And what boiling point means is that you can heat it, like you boil a kettle, right? And the water gets hotter and hotter and hotter up to 100 degrees. You keep putting energy in, it keeps getting hotter. And all that time it's evaporating. We'll get to the reason why in a minute. But when you get to 100 degrees C in the atmosphere we've got, if you keep adding more energy, the liquid water cannot get any hotter. It all turns into gas. So what boiling point is the temperature at which liquid water at atmospheric pressure cannot get any hotter. It has to evaporate. So now let's wind back to the lower temperatures. So we know actually that gas exists, that water exists as a gas at room temperature, because we measure humidity, right? That's the thing you hear on the weather forecast. People will say, oh, it's really humid today, or not. And that's because there is water present in the air, and that water is a gas. And we have different percentages for humidity. It's measured in various ways. So we know that we can measure humidity and it has different numbers. We usually give it as a percentage. But what that means is that all the time, even you and I are breathing in water right now. And actually, we know that because if we go outside on a cold day and we breathe out, we see our breath condense, right? We see it go from a gas to a liquid. So, of course, water exists as a gas at room temperature. And then the question is why? And the reason why is that if you imagine, you zoom in to the molecular level and think about a cup of water. And if you zoomed right in to see what the molecules are doing, they'd all be buzzing around and moving and bouncing into each other.
Yeah.
But as part of that process, some of them have got more energy than others, just statistically, like in a crowd, some people are moving a bit faster and a bit slower than others. So the molecules that are fastest, if they happen to be at the surface, they can pull themselves away from the rest of the liquid and escape into the air, because they don't have a sort of idea of a liquid or a gas, right? They're just attracted to the other water molecules. That keeps them in a liquid. And if they move fast enough, then they can overcome that the pull of the other molecules, just like escape velocity, you know, if you want to put things into orbit or into further out into space. So if they've got enough energy, they just break away. They just keep going because the pull of all the other water molecules isn't enough to keep them there. So actually what happens, if we imagine that you have perhaps one of those, you know, a reusable water bottle, you've got the lid on it. So it's got some water and it's got some air. And all the time, some of the molecules in the liquid are getting enough energy to escape. So they're zooming up and joining the gas. But then the other process that happens is that sometimes in the gas, molecules just statistically get a bit slower. And if they slow down enough and happen to bump into the water, then they rejoin the liquid. So what you have in that situation of your water bottle is a continual exchange. There are always water molecules evaporating because they happen to have a bit more energy. And there are always water molecules in the air that are gaseous turning back into a liquid because they happen to have a little bit less. And so actually there's always a balance between those two things. So when you're drying your clothes on the line, let's say it's a nice warm day, the relative humidity is very low, so there aren't very many water molecules already in the air. There aren't very many molecules that can land back on your clothes, but there are lots of molecules, relatively speaking, that have enough energy to escape. So because there are more evaporating than there are condensing, on average, your clothes dry. But it's an average thing. There are always molecules both condensing and evaporating. So it's the truth of it is that water coexists as a liquid and a gas, and there's always a balance. There's always some molecules going from liquid to gas and always some molecules going from gas to liquid. And if one of them is bigger than the other, then you get noticeable condensation or noticeable evaporation, drying off.
I'm imagining the on a molecular level now, my wet shirt on the line as sort of fizzing at the surface.
Yeah, well, not quite. It's not boiling. That's probably quite important. But it is, as those water molecules absorb the sun's energy, they're moving faster. So it's like watching, you know, bumper cars going on. And if you have a bumper car and the thing is that water is kind of weird because it is a liquid at room temperature. If you look at other gases that have a similar kind of structure, like hydrogen sulfide, for example, similar sort of molecule, two hydrogens and a bit of something else. It's a gas at room temperature and it isn't a liquid. And the reason that water is a liquid is that those molecules are really sticky because the hydrogen and the oxygen are polar. They've got very different charges. You've got all these positive and negative charges, this pool of positive and negative charges. So if a water molecule wants to escape, there's always a positive or a negative charge to pull it back in. So it takes quite a lot of energy for this little bumper car to overcome that pull of the charges and escape, but it is perfectly possible. So your shirt isn't exactly boiling, but there's definitely a lot of it's definitely quite lively.
That's great, Helen. Thank you so much for that.
No problem.
This one is from Jackie in Cork. She says, in the past, both Venus and Mars had liquid water and an atmosphere that could have been conducive to life. If we started digging around on their surfaces, would it be possible to find any traces of civilization before it got covered over? Now, that is a good question. And we have Lauren Salen on the phone. She's a paleontologist who knows a lot about geology. We had her on about mass extinctions. What do you think, Lauren? Could we detect ancient cities under the surface from millions of years ago?
So that's a great question. So as far as finding a civilization from that far back, so we're talking about 4 billion years ago or so when there was liquid water. So there's actually an entire body of research that is relevant to this because there's been a lot of discussion of what we might leave in the fossil record as a civilization going into the future. And this is relevant to discussions as to whether we're in a new geological time period, basically the Anthropocene. How would you define the Anthropocene if you were a paleontologist, say 4 billion years from now, looking backwards? Would you be able to see it? And the answer is kind of disappointing as far as human egos go, which is that humans aren't going to leave very much as it turns out. So a lot of the markers of civilization, the things that we think of as being everlasting, so we could include steel or concrete or plastics. So we talk about plastics in the ocean and leaving a microlayer. It turns out those things decay pretty rapidly. So within a few million years. So you're not going to see a layer of plastics that tell you something about a civilization that existed then. And there was actually a great article about this by Peter Brannon that was in the Atlantic last year that discussed this issue, basically what we expect to see. So plastics would go away, all of sort of the engineering feats that we're so proud of, that another civilization might be so proud of, would go away. And on top of that, even things like nuclear markers, we would expect those to survive. But the side effects of even nuclear tests tend to have a decay rate that's much faster than 4 billion years as well. And so this presents a problem in that, would you even be able to see it? So on Earth, we have separate problems that affect this too. We have sort of the tectonic plates are always moving and shifting around the different layers of the Earth, so everything gets moved. If we go back 4 billion years, we don't see very much because a lot of that crust has been destroyed and subducted sort of into the Earth itself or buried under or otherwise reworked. Luckily, on Mars, you don't really necessarily have this problem because they don't have tectonic action. On Venus, everything's already melted, so finding rocks on Venus seems pretty unlikely to begin with. But on Mars, if things haven't been reworked, you might get luckier. Of course, the other issue is the time span. If you have a civilization that only lasted as long as human civilization, so say 10,000 years, would you even be able to see a time period that is that short that long ago? And the answer is not necessarily. It turns out that as you get closer to the recent, and this has been observed over and over again, you get a much finer resolution of the fossil record than when you go further back. So further back, you might be able to say something happened within a, say, 1 to 5 million year time span or 100,000 year time span.
Wow.
If you're really lucky. More recently, you can get sort of carbon dating and say something happened with plus or minus 50 years. But that means that if you were to go to Mars or Venus and try to say that 4 billion years ago, there was a civilization that lasted for 10,000 years and then they all died out or whatever, you wouldn't be able to see it.
But what you might like, when we think about everything we've done to this planet, you're saying in terms of the layers of rock that accrue over time, it's completely insignificant.
Yes, that it's too short a period of time to really show up in the fossil record if you're millions of years out.
But what about, I'm hearing all the time about scientists, you know, drilling into rock and getting, you know, gas from millions of years ago to be able to tell what happened there. Is nothing preserved from now in the rock?
So that there might be. The issue is whether you would be able to tell it was a civilization. Now you might be able to see that there was a change, that there was a change associated with civilization. So there was a study that was published by Roy Plotnick, who's at the University of Illinois, Chicago, that suggested that what you might see is something that looks like a mass extinction, where if you had fossils beforehand that were diverse, you might see a fall in diversity. And so what he suggested was that if you were looking back at this time interval from the future, what you would see would be really diverse mammal, sort of megafaunal population. And this goes back into the last ice age as well. So you might see mammoths and saber-toothed cats and elephants and tigers and everything. And then suddenly all you would see would be humans and dogs and cattle and chickens. And then you would see those groups start to re-diversify following, say, the fall of civilization. And so it would look just like every other mass extinction that we've seen in the record, if you could go back that far. But that's assuming that those changes are persistent and that all of the civilization and their domesticated life is not suddenly wiped out, in which case you would just see sort of a blip and then the sudden return of all those things. Right. The other thing that you might see is that you might see the increase in carbon levels that are associated with industrialization. If it was a really thriving civilization and they didn't figure out a way to fix it, much as we're having trouble figuring out a way to fix it right now. So you might see that kind of excursion, but you wouldn't necessarily know that it was unnatural. So you might see an increase in carbon, but it might look like other increases in carbon through time. And so it would be really hard to tell that it was a civilization and not a naturally occurring turnover if you could see it at all.
It really reinforces our insignificance when you think about it. Lawrence Allen, thanks a million. Okay, next question. Are we ever in the same place twice? Oh, I think I know the answer to this. Who have we got for this?
We've got Ethan Seagull.
Ethan Seagull. Is that Ethan?
This is Ethan. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going? Welcome to Faster Proof. We are trying to answer as many questions as we can in one episode of this program. And so we've been asked, are we ever in the same place twice? The answer must surely be no.
Yeah, unfortunately it is, right? You'd think like, oh man, if all the forces line up, then, you know, the Earth spins on its axis and that'll put us back to where we are, and it revolves around the sun and the sun goes around the galaxy. And if all those things lined up, of course, right? We just end up right back where we started. But it turns out that no, because we're in a galaxy that moves through the universe, and there's these other galaxies and groups of galaxies that tug on us, and that actually pulls us through the universe at about 620 kilometers per second, faster than we go around the galaxy by about a factor of 3, faster than the Earth revolves around the sun by about a factor of 20. So no, unfortunately, if you ever wanted to return to the same place, you'd have to make sure that you accounted for all of those motions. Keep that in mind the next time you try and go back in time. Otherwise, you'll end up in the void of space if you don't also go back in space to where we were that certain amount of time ago.
Oh my God. No one has ever mentioned that in any time travel book, movie, or TV show I have ever witnessed. The idea that you can't go back in time because you'd be in empty space and die instantly of cold and suffocation, that's not something that is ever discussed. They just completely gloss over that. And actually, I'm really surprised. I'd never thought about that.
Let's do a little experiment for you, Jonathan. When is your birthday?
The 11th of the 5th, 1976.
11th May, 1976. Okay, so that means if you wanted to go back to your own birth and be there for the moment you were born, you would also not only have to go back in time, you know, 43 years, you would have to go back in space about 870 billion kilometers, or about a tenth of a light year.
Whoa, that is huge.
That is huge. In fact, if you wait until your 65th birthday, you'll have traveled 14% of a light year over the course of your lifetime. That's the approximate distance between Proxima Centauri, which is our nearest star, and Alpha Centauri, which is the second nearest star.
So hang on, if we're moving that much, then how come we don't get closer to stars?
Well, the answer is stars get closer and farther from us just as we all move throughout the galaxy. So we move with our sun in our own ellipse around the galactic center, but so does every other star.
Right.
And just like planets in our solar system get closer and farther over time, so do the stars. So Proxima Centauri, right now it's a little over 4 light years away. In a few tens of thousands of years, it'll be down to about 3 light years away. And then it'll move farther away again once it gets to that closest distance. So they do move closer and farther away, but none of them, and this is maybe thankfully, ever really just get closer and closer and closer until they run into us. At least if that happens, it hasn't happened to us yet.
If we're going around in a galaxy, then surely we're going around in some sort of a circle, which means surely at some point we may come back to where we are, or does that galaxy itself move, and is it just completely impossible for us to ever to go back to where we were?
You know, we do make these circular, these elongated circles called ellipses around the galactic center. So you can say, you know, hey, I can do the math and look at how fast we're moving and how far away we are. How long does it take for the sun to come back to its same exact position that it's in right now? And the answer is about 220 to 250 million years. So the last time that the sun and the Earth were in this position in the galaxy, this was before the Tyrannosaurus, before the Stegosaurus. This is back when a creature called Dimetrodon was the largest dominant thing on the Earth. This is back before mammals had really even evolved to become prominent creatures here on Earth. This is way before any of our, what we think of as primate ancestors, had come into being. So that's about how long it takes.
Okay, so when I finally get my children to sleep and they close their eyes, when they wake up 8 hours later, they feel like they're getting out of the same bed and out of the same space. But during that 8 hours, how far have they traveled in space without them even knowing it?
Without them knowing it, when you add up all those different motions, the Earth around the sun around the galaxy, and the galaxy flying through space relative to everything else we've discovered, over the span of 8 hours, your children will have traveled 18 million kilometers each night from when they close their eyes to when they open them again the next morning.
Oh my God. Wow. That is just so far off what I would have imagined. That sort of reminds me of that song at the end of The Meaning of Life, you know, that Monty Python movie. Is that in any way accurate then?
You know, it's amazing. When you look at what we know today and what we knew back then, that song has actually changed very little. It's still almost exactly right. I'm so pleased whenever anyone in film or media takes the time to do their homework and get this right. This song is maybe the most scientifically accurate astronomy and cosmology song that I've ever heard. So kudos to the Pythons, and rest in peace, Terry Jones.
Amazing. Thanks a million. That was brilliant, Ethan.
All right.
Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day.
In an outer space. This is Faster Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're answering lots of your questions this week, but this one was mine. And to answer it, we got a hold of Giles Yeo.
Hi, I'm Giles Yeo, and I'm an obesity expert at the University of Cambridge.
So a while back on the programme, Shane Bergen said that when we lose weight, it comes out not in our waist or our sweat, but in our breath. And I didn't believe him, so I wanted to get an actual expert on obesity to hopefully prove him wrong. Is he right then, Giles? When we go from 110 kilos to a trim 85, is that weight actually lost by breathing it out?
You breathe out the exhaust out in your breath. So, you know, if you consider fat as fuel and you're using it to burn, you then breathe out the exhaust. And the exhaust for when you actually burn fat happens to be carbon dioxide and water. And so technically speaking, it's true, but you're not breathing out fat. So your breath is not like, you know, a flammable or anything like that. It's not, you're not breathing out oil.
Right. So this breath, so we've, the two waste products is carbon dioxide, which obviously comes out through our mouth and nose. Mm-hmm. What about the water? Does that go into the bloodstream? Do we wee it out? Where does it go, the excess water?
So the excess water will come out as wee, as sweat, or as water vapor. In fact, as many other things, as tears as well. So anytime we excrete water, a part of that water is going to be the waste product of burning fat.
Oh, so when we're in the gym and we're sweating heavily because we're working, mm-hmm. is that the direct product of the fat burning, or is that a coincidence that that happens when we're exercising?
Oh, no. When we're actually sweating, the reason why we sweat when we're exercising is because we're giving off heat, and the sweat is just to help us cool down. Now, it just so happens that the water that comes out, some of that is going to have come from the breakdown of fat as well. I mean, obviously, the vast majority of water that comes out of us is stuff that we drink, okay, coming in. But some of that water is going to have come from the breakdown of fat.
Right. So how long then from burning the fat to it being breathed or sweat or weed out?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. The way that we actually, I don't know if there is a speed limit, okay, for how it actually comes out. So what happens when you actually burn fat and you get water, it then gets kind of like put back into the body, right? And a percentage of that water is then lost during normal day-to-day living, and that is when it comes out. So some of the fat, some of the water may stay in you for a long time, and some of it may actually come out. It's random. So don't lose fat-specific water. You just lose water.
So when we lose weight, Are we shedding fat cells? Is that what happens? Do they burn up and disappear? Or what happens to the fat cells?
I mean, that's what a lot of people think, but that's not actually true. So you have to think about your fat cells like balloons. So when you lose weight, they get smaller. When you gain weight, they get bigger. So that's all that's happening. These balloons that are ballooning up or actually shrinking back down, you don't actually gain or lose fat cells when you gain or lose weight.
Well, I would thank you, but you've just proven Shane Bergen right, which always grates on me.
I'm sorry.
Dr. Charles Yeo, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Charles' book is called Gene Eating, The Science of Obesity and the Truth About Diets. It's in shops now. Time for one more question, I think, and it's to do with light speed.
Hello.
Hi, is that Becky?
It is, yeah.
Becky, this is Jonathan from Future Proof, but we're doing a special thing on the program. It's called Faster Proof, and we sort of need your help with questions that we think you'd be able to answer.
Yeah, I'm up for that.
The thing is, we don't have an enormous amount of time, and these questions could actually take forever to answer, so good luck with that. All right, the first one is, if a distant star was hurtling towards us at close to the speed of light, it's a theoretical question, at what point would we notice it, says Simon?
Immediately, almost. Yeah, so, I mean, the closest star to us is actually part of a triple star system. So it's called Alpha Centauri. And in that, you've got Proxima Centauri, Alpha Centauri A, and Alpha Centauri B. And they're about 4 light years away. So that is a measure of distance. It means it takes light 4 years to travel that distance of about 25 trillion miles. So it's pretty far away. But if that star started to move towards us at, say, 90% of the speed of light, let's say, right? Then the light leaving that star would still reach us before the star got to us, thankfully. We'd still have like forewarning of it happening. But what does happen is that light starts to move towards us. So think about when like an ambulance or a police siren goes past you, right? You hear the change in the pitch of the siren, right? It gets higher as it comes towards you and then it gets lower as it goes away from you.
I thought that was just the sound of the siren. I thought the siren went, woo-hoo, but I didn't realize it was a constant noise that get altered by the distance it was away from you. I didn't realize that until I started this program, really.
If you download an app on your phone that can produce like a constant sound, you can do it just by sort of shaking the phone back and forward towards someone. They can hear it change, which is really cool. So because this is something that happens to waves and light is a wave, the same thing happens. But instead of pitch changing, the color of the light changes. Which means it can shift anything from, you know, red to green to blue, but also then to like ultraviolet or maybe even infrared. So actually, if this star was moving at 90% of the speed of light, the light would actually get shifted so much that we wouldn't be able to see it anymore. It would get shifted into ultraviolet. So what it would look like to us is that the star had just disappeared from the sky to our eyes, but not to, say, something like an ultraviolet telescope that could still detect it. Now, I think if it did start coming to us, obviously the light would leave it and then it would take 4 years to get to us. So we would know 4 years after it started to move, but we would know instantaneously that because it would disappear. Thankfully, the star would be going a little bit slower. So it'd probably be about 5 months behind the light. So I know we're talking theoretically here, but like we would have, you know, some forewarning. And you know, that's kind of cool to think about to me as well. It's like, it's a cool sort of thought experiment about the speed of light, but like that speed is so highly unlikely, right? The sun is moving around the Milky Way galaxy at 450,000 miles an hour, which sounds like a lot, but it's 0.06% of the speed of light. So
it's just insane. The speed of light is really fast.
Yeah, it's really fast. In fact, I think if you click your fingers, you would be in Australia quicker than that if you were moving at the speed of light. But it's also really cool that we, right now, as we sit here and listen to this, are moving at 450,000 miles an hour. Because the Earth is going around the sun, the sun's moving around the Milky Way.
I'm going backwards, it seems. I feel like I'm going backwards. So, Becky, we actually have one more question. It's the last question, but we've absolutely run out of time. So I hope you have a short answer for us. Gene was asking about the Voyager probes, which were sent out in the 70s. People may remember Carl Sagan was involved and so on, and they put a golden record on it. Anyway, they've been traveling for decades and are now at the edges of our solar system or possibly gone beyond. And Gene wants to know, will they ever enter another solar system?
Nope.
That's a really good short answer, actually. Let's just leave it there. Dr. Becky Smethurst from the University of Oxford, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
If you're anything like me, you are dying to ask the next question, which is, of course, why not? But I think that's a really good place to leave you in this episode, where we found you asking questions and being curious. We hope you enjoyed this special episode of Future Proof. Thanks so much to our contributors, Giles Yeo, Helen Chersky, Ethan Segal, Nick Lane, Lauren Salen, Karen Lloyd, and Becky Smethurst. You don't know what's going on. Putting this episode together was a gargantuan task, but our producer, Aidan McKelvey, was equal to it. He and I edited the program. On sound was Jojo Cardozo, and a special thank you to Neil Kavanagh. Simon Keane was researching, as always. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Just a quick note to say thanks very much for rating, subscribing, and listening. If you are listening for the first time, let someone know about Future Proof. We really appreciate that too. We'll be back with more Future Proof business as usual in the next podcast, which is coming out during the week in Future Proof Extra. In the meantime, stay curious.